We can jump back to Cerberus without having to travel cross-country to the unit in the Sierra Nevadas.
Grant shifted his feet uncomfortably.
My thought exactly.
You mean now? Just jump back to Cerberus without telling anybody?
Kane eyed him closely.
We can give word to Dubois if he's still around.
Grant didn't seem enamored of the idea, and both Bridget and Kane guessed he wasn't too anxious to leave Shizuka, much less without a goodbye. However, he wasn't about to put those objections into words.
Let's find it first.
She indicated a door at the far end of the room.
That may lead to it.
The three people walked to the door, and to their surprise, it opened automatically at their approach. As they stepped into a narrow accessway beyond, sensors in the walls reacted to their motion signature and overhead neon strips flashed on, shedding a wavery illumination.
Damn considerate.
As they walked down the passageway, they became aware of a low hum of sound ahead of them, almost like the vibrations of a gong that had been struck. Presently, a brighter light glimmered in the murk just beyond a tall arch, and the hum at the edges of their hearing became a continuous whine. The air seemed to shiver with the sound. The archway led onto a railed catwalk overlooking a vast chamber, shaped like a hollow hexagon, and far larger than looked possible from the outside. A dim glow shone from the high, flat ceiling, two faint columns of light beaming from twin fixtures, both the size of wag tires. Massive, wedge-shaped ribs of metal supported the roof. The shafts of luminescence fell upon a huge forked pylon made of some burnished metal that projected up from a sunken concave area in the center of the chamber. The two horns of the pylon curved up and around, facing each other. Mounted on the tips of each prong were spheres that looked as if they had been sculpted from multifaceted quartz crystals. Skeins of electricity danced with sizzling pops between them. Kane guessed it was at least 20 feet tall, with 10 feet between the forking branches. Extending outward from the base of the pylon, at ever-decreasing angles, into the low shadows, was a taut network of fiber-optic filaments. They disappeared into sleeve sockets that perforated the plates of dully gleaming alloy sheathing the floor. Many of them were buckled here and there, bulging but not showing splits. The catwalk led to a central control complex. Instrument consoles with glass-covered gauges and computer terminals lined the walls. The banks of computers chittered like a flock of startled birds, and drive units hummed purposefully. The right-hand wall was completely covered by armaglass, running the entire 20-yard length of the room. On the far side of it, they saw the jump chamber. Electronic equipment and machinery rose from plinths and podia, and none of the three of them had any idea of its function or purpose. Overhead lights gleamed on alloys, glass coverings, the CPUs. Chairs rose from the floor before each console. Kane counted 10 chairs. Covering four walls were crystal-fronted vid screens. Blinding light shone from some of the screens, others showed only whorls of color. As they passed the screens on the way to the gateway unit, Grant suddenly froze in mid-stride. Both Bridget and Kane followed his transfixed gaze to a monitor screen. Neither of them made a sound when they saw what had frozen Grant into immobility, but only because their vocal cords were paralyzed. Despite the high aerial perspective, they recognized the scene instantly. They saw the hangar at Area 51, the last desperate seconds of the battle when Ramirez and his mags turned on Grant and Bridget. Kane saw himself preparing to throw the implode grin, with bullets kicking up sand and concrete all around him. A stray slug caught him in the arm, and despite his armor, sent him staggering, the Gren falling from his hand and rolling across the concrete toward the elevator cupola. Domi darted out from the cupola, scooped up the Gren in one hand, and cocked her arm back to throw it at the vehicle. Grant rushed toward her, and though there was no sound, they saw his mouth working as he bellowed at her to drop the Gren. Then her diminutive form was completely engulfed by a brilliant blaze of white light. Frozen in place, Kane and Grant watched as the tremendous suction created by the implosion yanked their bodies forward in headlong, clumsy somersaults. Then the scene broke up in jagged lines and pixels before reforming to replay itself again. Grant was the first to speak.
What the fuck is this? How can this be?
Kane had no answer, standing in stupefied shock, barely able to breathe, much less speak. He figured Bridget had no response either.
Operation Kronos!
Kane and Grant turned to regard her, their eyes wide with surprise. They all knew Operation Kronos had been a subdivision of the Totality Concepts over Project Whisper, as had Project Cerberus. Unlike Cerberus, however, they had always assumed nothing remained of its researches, either failures or successes. Before they could compose themselves sufficiently to question Bridget, she spoke, her words almost tumbling over one another.
This place must have been a research center, affiliated with the Totality Concept. What we have here is a version, maybe a prototype, maybe a debugged one, of the Operation Kronos Temporal Dilator.
Her eyes glinted like emeralds.
We know Operation Kronos reached a point where they were able to inject remote vid probes into past timelines, and I think this is what we're seeing here. A visual log of the battle at Area 51, the seconds preceding Domi's disappearance.
It took Kane a moment to comprehend her choice of words.
You said disappearance, not death.
What are you trying to say, goddammit?
Bridget ran her hands through her mane of hair.
Kane, your instincts were right when they told you Domi wasn't dead. She wasn't killed in the implosion. She was time-trawled.
You don't know that. How could you know that?
Grant whirled to face Bridget so quickly and violently that she involuntarily flinched from him. Kane almost snapped at Grant to back off and calm down, but adrenaline was speeding through his own system, making his stomach muscles cramp and his hands tremble. Bridget understood the reasons for Grant's agitation and didn't respond in kind.
I admit it's supposition at this point, but it'll be simple enough to test the theory. We know time travel is possible. Remember what Lakesh told us about Operation Kronos and its experiments? He said they forced temporal breaches or dilations in the Kronon structure. The purpose of Kronos was to find a way to enter probability gaps between one interval of time and another. Inasmuch as Cerberus utilized quantum events to reduce organic and inorganic material to digital information and transmit it through hyperdimensional space, Kronos was built on that same principle to peep into other timelines and even trawl living matter from the past and perhaps the future. That's obviously what's been going on here. It's the only reasonable explanation for the extinct life forms and the relics of past ages.
Yeah, I also remember Lakesh saying Operation Kronos had triggered a probability wave dysfunction when they disrupted the Kronon structure. He claimed they created an alternate future scenario for humanity, and that led up to the nuke cost itself. So maybe we shouldn't fool around with this stuff.
I don't think we can make the world any worse than it is.
She studied the machinery and the instrument boards.
Apparently, whoever activated all of this zeroed in on us with vid probes, like we did when we tested the Omega Path program.
Yeah, but why? Who would be observing us?
I don't know. I have enough things to speculate about right now.
She didn't smile when she said it. Grant visibly struggled to compose himself, squaring his shoulders.
So you're saying Domi was snatched, trawled, right at the instant when the grin went off?
That's what it looks like.
Grant swept a hand toward the repeating sequence of Domi vanishing in the blaze of the grin's detonation, but avoided looking at it.
Then where the hell is she?
Two vertical lines of deep concentration appeared on either side of Bridget's nose. She sat in the nearest chair, running her fingers lightly over the multitude of readout gauges, blinking buttons, and keyboards without touching them.
The quantum interface matter confinement channels are online with the Kronon waveguide. The wave function and state vectors are all in sync. The coordinates have already been programmed and locked in. It's only waiting for the final sequence to initiate retrieval.
Retrieval? Retrieve her from where? Or rather, when? That particular day? That very second?
Bridget absently combed nervous fingers through her hair.
No. In my estimation, she's already been retrieved, but not yet rematerialized. The trawling process hasn't been completed. She's in a state of non-existence, reduced to her basic energy form, not too different from a gateway's quincunx effect.
Both men had picked up enough techno-vernacular in the past year or so to understand that the quincunx effect referred to a nanosecond of time when lower-dimensional space was phased into a higher dimension.
This is all guesswork. You can't change the past by pushing a few buttons.
Bridget swiveled in the chair to stare directly into his face.
What's the nature of time anyway, Grant? Can you describe it to me? when the most advanced physicists of the pre-dark world barely understood it? Before the new cost, modern science was just beginning to perceive that subatomic particles and quantum events made no distinction between space and time. The laws of physics are fixed only by our perception. According to Lakesh, that was the major problem both Project Cerberus and Operation Kronos personnel constantly grappled with. Another was computing the precise temporal transfer points. Cerberus moved things from place to place. Kronos had to deal with moving things from place to place and time to time. In certain circumstances, photons, the particles of which light is made, could apparently jump between two points separated by a barrier in what appears to be zero time. The process, known as tunneling, was even used to make some of the most sensitive electron microscopes. If the very existence of time depends on the presence of space, then time is only a variable, not an absolute. Therefore, you can have more than one event horizon, which means you can have more than one outcome from an event.
Nobody's arguing with you on this point. You're way smarter than we are, all right? We settled that a long time ago. But there are still a couple of areas we need to explore.
Like what?
Uneasily, Kane glanced from the control panels to the pylon to the vid screens.
First of all is the microwave pulse. It's obvious, whenever this temporal dilator thing is turned on, it sends out the burst.
Brigid nodded toward the armaglass barrier.
We should be safe from it behind the shielding. You know enough of the properties of armaglass to know that it goes opaque when exposed to certain levels and wavelengths of radiation. That's one of the reasons it's used in the Mattrans gateways, to block energy overspills.
Fine. One area dealt with. That leaves us with the second. Who the hell set up all of this for us? How do we know this isn't bait to trick us into pushing a button and blowing us and maybe this whole region of the Cific to atoms?
Who would do that?
Kane shrugged.
I can think of a couple of past sparring partners who might have the know-how, but they're dead, I hope. You can't deny this entire arrangement is just a little too convenient for us to accept at face value.
Whoever set this up offered us two choices. We do nothing, and Domi is lost to us forever, or we can engage the final sequence and at least initiate a chance to have her returned. I personally think that's worth taking the risk of blowing ourselves up. But then, that's me.
She waited for Grant and Kane to respond. The uncomfortable silence seemed to stretch on for hours.
That's me, too. Do it.
Kane didn't realize he hadn't been breathing until Grant spoke.
Me too. Do it, Baptiste.
Brigid turned her chair to the console, and her fingers flew over the keyboard like a concert pianist's. She hit a final button with a dramatic flourish.
Now we'll see what...
The throbbing vibration that had been at the edges of their hearing and awareness since they entered the huge chamber abruptly climbed in scale and pitch, becoming almost painful. Sparks that were more energy than light flashed through the facets of the prisms, sizzling fingers of it darting from one sphere to the other and back again. The crackling display of electricity between the forks of the pylon increased until a virtual ribbon of blue current seemed to stretch from one to the other. The air between the prongs began to waver in a blurry shimmer like heat waves rising off sunbaked asphalt. For an instant, they glimpsed a swirling movement in the air, such as the ripples made in water when a fish swam close to the surface. Tiny, glittering specks, like motes of diamond dust, appeared within the area of distortion. They spun, then whirled faster and faster, turning into a funnel cloud, like a tornado made of gold and silver confetti. A powerful wind built. A bone-jarring crack of thunder compressed their eardrums. The funnel cloud peeled back on itself as vivid bursts of color poured out from within it. A shape began to materialize, sliding into sharp focus. All of their ears were struck by a continuous blast of sound, as if a thunderstorm of unparalleled fury were breaking loose inside the building. A deafening, concussive blast cannonaded from the pylon, then a consecutive series of brutal, overlapping shockwaves crashed into the armaglass barrier. They could feel the pounding, like invisible breakers crashing into a seawall. Waves of dazzling white flame and variegated lightning streaked and blazed. The entire control complex vibrated like a heavy surf, pounding relentlessly against their eardrums and bones. From the curving prongs spit sharp bolts of lightning, which whipped and hissed along the network of wires like serpents made of blue plasma. Their surroundings became like the negative of a pix, white on black, with all the colors bleached out. Crooked fingers of energy continued to stab between the prongs, forming a cat's cradle of red lightning. They watched with awe and dread as thousands of crackling threads of light coalesced in the center of the forks. Gushing lines of energy formed a luminous cloud between the prongs, and almost faster than the eye could perceive, the cloud grew more dense and definite of outline. The shimmer built to a blinding borealis. Then a star seemed to go nova, bringing a millisecond of eye-searing brilliance. The funnel cloud burst apart in fragments, as if a giant mirror shattered, and the shards flew out in all directions. Amid the flying, glittering splinters, a small body plummeted out of the heart of darkness and fell heavily to the platform. The body wore a black, bulky combat vest, which contrasted sharply with her porcelain-hued skin and bone-white hair. The three of them watched in shocked silence as Domi pushed herself to all fours on trembling arms and vomited. Bridget reached Domi first, sliding down a metal ladder that extended from the catwalk to the floor below. From the prongs of the pylon came a throbbing, insistent vibration. All around, the whine of machinery climbed up out of the audible range, straining to hit an ultrasonic note. Bridget had no idea what was happening, but she knew it wasn't right. She felt the feathery touch of energy, as if she were breasting invisible waves of static electricity. The bright flares of plasma continued to leap and carom from the pair of crystal prisms on the pylon's prongs. Little flames, gold and orange and greenish-blue, created a shimmering nimbus all up and down their lengths. Domi dragged the back of her hand over her mouth and looked around, dazed and uncomprehending.
We take out Mags? We get him?
Kane went to her side and pulled her to her feet. His vision swam and blurred with tears. Domi tottered dizzily, sagging into his arms. His relief was so overwhelming he couldn't speak, but he doubted Domi could hear him over the shuddering vibrations anyway. Casting a glance over his shoulder, he saw Grant standing at the foot of the ladder, as motionless as a statue. The quartz spheres continued to crackle and spark, spitting arcs of energy in random corkscrewing patterns. One passed by Bridget's cheek, fanning it with a hot, tingling shock. The spiral sprang up to caress the armaglass barrier, leaving a smoldering scorch mark. She turned to Kane.
This thing isn't downcycling. It's running out of control. We need to get out of here before it releases another radiation pulse.
The floor suddenly heaved beneath their feet, the metal plates squealing, rivets popping loose with the sound of gunshots. Kane, Bridget, and Domi reeled. The Outlander girl would have fallen, but Grant reached her with one long-legged bound. In one motion, he hoisted her into his arms like a child and started climbing back up the ladder, pulling himself and her along by one arm. Light lanced from the prongs of the pylon, two coruscating fountains of fiery sparks that shed glowing droplets of molten silver. Bridget and Kane recoiled, shielding their faces. The smell of hot metal and ozone filled their nostrils.
What the fuck is going on?
Some kind of feedback pulse, like another energy signature intercepted and interfered with the output here.
They scaled the ladder quickly as fire filled the chamber below them. A solid wall of blue flame that became a pure white light so bright they couldn't even look at it directly. When they reached the catwalk, they dashed for the MAT-TRANS unit. Grant was already halfway there, Domi limp in his arms, her head wobbling in rhythm to his footfalls. As they passed the control consoles, they saw the needles on the power gauges flicking back and forth like metronomes, setting crazed rhythms. The indicator lights flashed erratically. Switching stations clicked. A console squirted a shower of sparks that smelled like scorched roses. They piled into the jump chamber. Bridget paused by the keypad control to tap in the destination lock code to the Cerberus unit. Pulling the metal handle affixed to the center of the armaglass door, Kane sealed the chamber. The sec lock clicked, and the automatic transit process began. All of them understood, in theory, that the MAT-TRANS units required a dizzying number of maddeningly intricate electronic procedures, all occurring within milliseconds of one another, to minimize the margins for error. The actual conversion process was automated for this reason, sequenced by an array of computers and microprocessors. Though they accepted at face value that the machines worked, it still seemed like magic to Bridget, Kane, and Grant. The disks above and below them exuded a silvery glow, and wraiths of white mist formed on the ceiling and floor. Tiny static discharges, like miniature lightning bolts, flared in the vapor. As if from a great distance came a whine, which quickly grew in pitch to a drone, then to a howl like a gale-force wind. Behind the armaglass walls, bursts of color flared and flashed. The characteristic hurricane howl of the gateway cycling through a dematerialization was drowned out by the hammering. Then a force struck all four people with a tremendous impact, knocking them into oblivion. The universe exploded in a blaze of unidentifiable colors and images. Kane had the sensation of falling forever into a bottomless abyss. A nightmare vision of distorted space, of tangled geometrical shapes so crazed and complex it was impossible for his mind to absorb them. A never-ending stream of brilliant spheres passed by him. He retained a measure of consciousness, and for some reason he knew each sphere was a separate universe, a separate reality. Universes upon universes, realities upon realities, bobbing in the cosmic quantum stream like bubbles. He hurtled between them, following a complicated, twisting course, yet at the same time, it seemed as if he were flying in a straight line. He had felt frightened and trapped before, but never had he felt so crushed and helpless and impotent as now, and his mind recoiled from the effort to comprehend this welter of insanity, this streaming rush of extra-dimensional space. He knew he was hurtling headlong into a cluster of madness. One of the bright spheres loomed up ahead of him, and he tried to swerve away from it, around it. Then only darkness surrounded him, the utter blackness of complete nothingness, of the empty spaces between the stars. The void boiled in his mind like a cauldron of pitch the size of the universe itself. Then small slits of light appeared, gray and distant. He became aware of his body again. Kane opened his eyes, and the first thing he saw was the sun moving across a cloudless sky of purest, cleanest azure. It seemed to hover, then cross the sky in fits and starts. Pain came next, and then smell, a stink of burned grease, of scorched oil clogging his nostrils and coating his tongue. He felt a pounding as of rock hammers against the sides of his head. His awareness slowly returned in bits and pieces and in no particular order. He heard a strange bass hum, as of a musical note refusing to fade. He tasted blood mixed in with the chemical stink and realized it slid from his nostrils. The numbness in his limbs receded, and Kane felt a deep, boring pain in the middle of his back and the center of his chest. With aching muscles, he heaved himself up on his elbows. Uncomprehending, he stared at the film of oil ashes covering his armor. His stomach heaved and twisted as he bit back a groan of pain. That groan was echoed from his left, and he hitched around, though it made his head spin. His sight was impaired due to the black smears on the helmet's visor, but he saw Brigid, Grant, and Domi lying sprawled on what appeared to be interconnecting flagstones. All of them looked as if they had been cleaning chimneys with their bodies. A layer of soot and ashes covered them from head to toe. Kane turned over, lurching to his hands and knees. He stayed where he was, panting for breath. With effort, he undid the underjaw locking guard of his helmet and tugged it off over his head. He looked around. His vision was still blurred. He realized he and his friends lay on the brow of a grassy hill overlooking a thickly wooded valley roughly a mile across. A river flowed through it, the foaming blue waters cascading down a gentle fall to the west. The area didn't look familiar, certainly not like the Bitterroot Range where the Cerberus Redoubt was hidden. With a surge of unreasoning panic, he suddenly realized they weren't even in a gateway chamber, much less in the redoubt. He turned his head slightly to see more of his surroundings. Then he froze. At first squinting, then staring with ever-widening eyes at the vast pyramidal structure shouldering the blue sky. It was composed of countless fitted blocks of stone, the top perfectly flat. Bright sunlight played along the white facade of the monstrous monolith. At its base, he saw tiny, dark moving specks and a couple of larger moving specks. He finally identified them as men and vehicles. Kane tried to estimate the pyramid's size by using the men and vehicles as reference points. He could only hazard a feeble guess. A 50-story building rising angularly from a 12-acre base was the best he could come up with. He realized the pyramid was of such staggering proportions as to make its true distance from him difficult to gauge. He also realized he was so stupefied by what his eyes were seeing that he was in a mild state of shock. Kane had never really devoted too much thought to how ancient peoples had constructed massive megalithic structures. Even the mind-staggeringly huge step pyramid he and his friends had seen on Mars several months ago failed to rouse his curiosity. But now he gaped open-mouthed at the most enormous and finely engineered Terran structure he had ever seen. It was almost too awesome to comprehend, and Kane had to consciously resist the impulse to slap himself. As it was, he stared so long and so hard without blinking in the blaze of sunlight that his eyes began to sting and water. He figured he and his friends were at least a quarter of a mile from the pyramid's base, yet the immensity of it completely filled his field of vision. Slowly, painfully, he got to his feet, wavering like a reed in a stiff breeze. He took a tottering step, then another one, and his legs buckled. He sat down hard on Grant's midriff. Grant jackknifed at the waist, causing Kane to fall over onto his right side.
God damn it, get off me!
Sorry.
Kane tried to get to his hands and knees again. His brain felt as if it were turning pirouettes inside his skull. Domi and Brigid stirred slowly, lifting their heads, frowning at, then brushing at the layer of soot on their limbs. Domi looked like a negative image of herself, coated black from head to toe. Kane saw and smelled how the ends of both women's hair were slightly charred. He scooted around to help Brigid sit up, and he nearly collapsed atop her. She pushed him away, looking into his face, then over at Domi and Grant.
Tar babies all. Br'er Rabbit would flee from us screaming.
Kane had no idea what she was talking about. He relegated her cryptic remark to post-jump delirium and didn't ask for clarification. Domi blinked repeatedly, wrinkling her nose at the oil smell and the stink of burned hair. She turned her head toward Grant as he struggled to attain a sitting position.
Did the Gren do this to us?
Grant fumbled with the lock on his helmet and finally managed to pull it off. The top half of his face was its normal deep brown complexion, while the lower part was as jet black as his mustache. Domi stared at him, then giggled. He glared at her.
What's so damn funny?
She didn't answer, and when Grant got a good look at Kane, he figured out the source of her mirth. Domi stared around.
This doesn't look like Nevada to me.
She stopped giggling abruptly, as if a volume knob had been turned to the off position. Brigid and Grant followed her gaze and shared similar reactions of stupefied silence when they saw the pyramid.
What is that? Where is that?
I don't know. I've never seen anything like it.
Slowly, as if he were 90 years old, Kane climbed to his feet again. He stood, swaying, his stomach lurching. When he was sure he wasn't going to be sick, he spoke.
What the hell happened to us? Why aren't we in a jump chamber?
That's what I want to know. First, we were in that dreamland place. Then there was an explosion. Next thing I remember, I'm puking my guts out, and then we're here.
Brigid regarded her with a long, appraising stare.
You don't remember anything else?
Domi narrowed her eyes.
What else is there to remember?
Nothing.
Grant staggered to his feet. He gave both Brigid and Kane a meaningful stare.
Nothing at all.
He extended his hand to Domi, who, after hesitating a couple of seconds, took it and allowed Grant to pull her effortlessly to her feet.
Are you all right?
He didn't release her hand.
Why shouldn't I be?
Troubled, she glanced from his face to those of Brigid and Kane.
Why is everybody treating me like a jolt brain? You act like you didn't expect to see me again.
No, that's not it.
Grant let go of her hand. He began to turn away again, then turned quickly, catching the girl's slim form in a crushing embrace. He pressed his cheek against the top of Domi's head. He squeezed his eyes shut.
Thank God. Thank God.
For a moment, a confused Domi tried to wriggle free. Then slowly she put her arms around his waist. In Vil society, with conditioning to place the wants of the many above the needs of the few, love among humans was the hardest bond to break. People were conditioned to believe that since all humans were intrinsically evil, to love each other was evil. That was certainly one reason why Grant had been so reluctant to involve himself with Domi. But the actual, far deeper motivation was fear. He couldn't look at Domi's white skin and crimson eyes without the image of Olivia's café au lait face, deep brown eyes, and black hair superimposing itself over the girl's features. There had been women since Olivia, but no real passion, and certainly no love. As a magistrate, whenever he felt the need for sexual release, all he had to do was make a transcom call, and a woman would be sent up to him. In the years since he had lost Olivia, he never spoke of her, and did his best not to think of her. He had deliberately frozen the softer emotions within him. Domi was a painful reminder of those emotions, although she was as different from Olivia physically and temperamentally as it was possible for a woman to be. An uninhibited, loving animal with no shame about her desires, Domi still resisted invitations from the other men in the redoubt. She wanted only him. And now Grant was beginning to come to terms with the fact that he not only wanted her, but also he needed her. Tears spilled from Bridget's eyes and cut twin runnels in the black film on her cheeks. She averted her gaze from Kane, who still offered her a hand. He pulled her up, and they stumbled, holding on to each other to keep from falling down the hill.
How did we end up here? Wherever here is.
She shook her head, little flakes of ash flying from tresses and irritating Kane's eyes.
I can't even hazard the most extreme guess, Kane.
Freeze!
The shout, coming from behind them, caused Kane to heel around so quickly he felt twinges of pain in his neck tendons. His head reeled with vertigo and caused amoeba-shaped floaters to swim over his eyes, so when he saw who had shouted, he wondered for a moment if he were hallucinating. A squad of four men came up the crest of the hill, all of them identically clad in trim black uniforms made of a satiny material. They wore high black boots, ebony leggings, and tailored tunics. Emblazoned on the left sleeve, there was a familiar symbol, a red, thick-walled pyramid enclosing and partially bisected by three elongated but reversed triangles. Small disks topped each one, lending them a resemblance to round-hilted daggers. All four of the Cerberus exiles recognized the patch as the unifying insignia of the Archon Directorate. Kane's belly fluttered in a cold anger, but not really surprise. He knew the symbol was supposed to represent some kind of pseudo-mystical triad functioning within a greater, all-embracing body. To him, all it represented was the co-opting and deliberately planned extinction of the human race. The four men fanned out around the top of the hill and surrounded them. Two of the men looked Asian. The other pair were Occidental, but all four wielded slender SIG-AMT auto-rifles with a great deal of skill. Kane noticed how they instinctively kept out of the way of one another's blasters. None of them had any particular expression on their faces, not even curiosity, at the four people coated with soot as black as their uniforms. They were commanded to disarm, but Kane and Grant didn't move, both of them weighing the odds. As if reading their thoughts, the two Asians shifted the barrels of their weapons to Domi and Brigid. Grimacing, Kane unbuckled his sin-eater and dropped it at his feet. A heartbeat later, Grant followed suit.
Now that we've been so cooperative, can you tell us where we are?
Just stand there.
The crew-cut man's tone was neutral, but he bit out the words as if he begrudged Kane every syllable. The rising and falling drone of an engine, overlaid by a mechanical clank and clatter, reached their ears. Kane turned slowly, pausing in case one of the armed men objected. When they didn't, his friends did the same, gazing down the slope in the direction of the sound. Shading his eyes with his hands, Kane saw a cloud of dust approaching the hill from the western corner of the pyramid.
Here comes somebody who might be inclined to answer our questions.
That's a sandcat.
Kane, Bridget, and Grant squinted at the distant box-like shape kicking up a plume of dust, but they couldn't pick out details. However, they knew the Outlander girl's eyesight was acute to the point of being uncanny. Within half a minute, the vehicle drew closer, and with a rising sense of anxiety and surprise, they saw Domi's identification was correct. The sandcat slowly crawled up the face of the hill, the clank and clatter of its metal treads sounding strangely subdued, as did the growl of the 750-horsepower engine. Its gray armored hull plowed through the rippling grass like the blunt prow of a ship. Like most everything in use by the Baronies, the sandcat was based on an existing pre-dark framework. Designed as a fast attack vehicle for a ground war that was never fought, the Sandcat's low-slung, blocky chassis was supported by a pair of flat, retractable tracks. The gun turret, concealed within an armored bubble topside, held a pair of USMG 73 heavy machine guns. The hull's armor was composed of a ceramic armaglass bond, which served as protection not only from projectiles, but went opaque when exposed to energy-based weapons, such as particle beam emitters. The vehicle topped the crest of the hill, and everyone moved back out of its way. Although he looked, Kane couldn't see who was driving it through the Obport. The Sandcat came to a clattering halt, and the engine was keyed off. The gullwing doors on either side opened, and three figures climbed out onto the hilltop. But the four captives had eyes only for the man sliding from the pilot's seat. A middle-aged man with tousled gray hair and an olive complexion tugged at the hem of his shiny black tunic and swept them with a jittery smile. He spoke in Lakesh's voice. "Welcome to China, children!" In the weeks since the disappearance of Kane and Domi, and the many days that had passed since Grant and Bridget Baptiste left the Cerberus installation in search of them, Lakesh found to his consternation that he experienced a great deal of difficulty adjusting to the absence of the four people. Despite the fact Cerberus had functioned longer without them than with them, they had become the focal points around which all the events seemed to revolve. Of course, he reminded himself, the redoubt hadn't functioned as much more than a hideout, a bolt hole for the various exiles from the baronies. The people Lakesh had recruited to staff Cerberus were primarily academics, tech heads, specialists in a variety of fields. Farrell, like Kata and Bry, received training in cybernetics, and Wegman was an engineer. All of them had led structured, sheltered lives in their respective vills. Only with the arrival of Kane, Grant, Bridget, and Domi had the Cerberus resistance movement initiated action of any sort. Until their arrival, the Cerberus resistance movement had consisted of little more than intelligence gathering. Kane and Grant acted on that intel, performing as the enforcement arm of Cerberus. In that capacity, they had not only scored a number of victories against the Barons, but also contended with other threats. There had been casualties since their recruitment. Adrian and Davis in Mongolia, Kata in the Antarctic, and Bethlee Rauch right within the vanadium walls of the installation itself. The prospect that Kane and Domi might be added to the casualty list was more than sad. If they were killed, it would be devastating. If Grant and Bridget Baptiste perished in the attempt to discover the fates of Kane and Domi, the work of Cerberus would end. He knew he wouldn't have the heart to recruit more people to compose, as Kane wryly put it, the enforcement arm of the operation. And even if he had the heart, his access to qualified people was exceptionally limited now that he was an exile himself. So when Lakesh saw Bridget, Domi, Grant, and Kane all bizarrely blackened but apparently whole and substantially uninjured, his knees went momentarily weak with relief. Only when he saw the surprise and suspicion gleaming in the four people's eyes did he realize he wasn't the doddering, wizened pedant they knew as Lakesh.
"It is I. It truly is. I've had something of a makeover."
Bridget and Kane had seen a younger version of Lakesh during their journey back to an alternate timeline. Bridget had also seen pics of Lakesh when he was younger, so they at least saw the resemblance. Bridget found her tongue first.
"I'd say it was more of a miracle than a makeover."
Sam stepped forward, smiling his disarming cherubic smile.
"Not really. I merely reversed the deterioration in his cellular structure and increased his body's production of two antioxidant enzymes, catalase and superoxide dismutase. I also boosted up his alkyglycerol level to the point where I reversed the aging process."
"So that's not a miracle?"
Kane angled an eyebrow at the boy.
"Not if you know how to do it."
Sam's smile broadened.
"My name is Sam. I brought you four here. It looks like the transit was a rough one. I'm sorry."
"You brought us here? How?"
"I opened up a localized wormhole. Unfortunately, I didn't foresee interference from a secondary energy pattern. I'm afraid the electromagnetic discharge of the two patterns meeting and merging left all of you rather the worse for wear."
Erica moved closer, hands on her flaring hips. She eyed them all boldly, but the gaze she flicked toward Kane and Grant was frankly carnal. Kane met her stare.
"And you are?"
"Erica is my name. I'm an old acquaintance of Mohandas and Sam's mother."
Kane nodded as if he had expected her to say something along those lines.
"I'm just guessing here, mind you.
But I'll bet Sam has a nickname. The Imperator, right?
How could you have possibly known that?
I get around.
He jerked his head toward Bridget, Domi, and Grant.
We all do. My question for you, Mohandas, is this. What the hell are you doing here?
He is helping me, as I hope you four will help me. Help you to do what?
Sam smiled almost shyly, and when he spoke again, his voice was different. Lakesh realized he was manipulating the timbre and pitch so the vibrations would resonate sympathetically to the inner ear and stimulate the neuroenergy system.
To institute a new form of unification. Reunification, actually. Not just to the Vills, but to the world. It is a task that I was created to undertake and fulfill. As the hybrids were envisioned as the bridge between the old and new human, I symbolize what lies on the other side.
Grant folded his arms over his sooty chest.
From what we've been told, there may be some Barons who aren't interested in what lies on the other side.
Sam acknowledged the comment with a short nod.
Reunification cannot succeed with dissension, no independent or individual agendas. This is a matter of survival, and we're all in it together. Humans, hybrids, Barons, and Outlanders alike.
Kane looked Lakesh up and down.
Then that's the uniform of reunification, right? It didn't take much to swing you to his side, did it?
Lakesh ran a hand through his thick hair.
It seemed the least I could do.
And what is the least you can do? Will you join our cause? Apply your resources and gifts to reunifying the planet?
For the sake of argument, what if we decline?
For the sake of argument, I fear I cannot allow X-Factors such as yourselves to run free, unfettered. You would cause too much chaos.
Is that a threat?
Not at all. It would be a grave regret.
Lakesh didn't like the direction the conversation was going. He stepped between Sam and Bridget, lifting conciliatory hands.
This is not the best time or place to discuss this. My friends are tired, and as you can see, in dire need of refreshing themselves. Let's go back to the pyramid and give ourselves time to think everything through.
Kane narrowed his eyes, staring first at Lakesh, then at the pyramid.
What's in that place, anyway?
More than you can imagine. It's the heart of the Earth.
It has every creature comfort, even a gateway unit.
He said it so casually, Kane knew he was making a point. Sam waved to the Sandcat.
Please get aboard.
Kane, Domi, Bridget, and Grant didn't move. Sam snapped his fingers toward a black-uniformed soldier.
I think they need a little persuasion.
The crew-cut man came up behind Bridget and gave her a shove with the frame of his blaster. Raising her boot, Bridget stamped down hard on the soldier's instep, raking the edge of the heel down his shin. It was a move she'd learned from Grant and Kane in Cerberus Redoubt. The man yelped in pained surprise. He was still yelping when Kane chopped him across the throat with the edge of his right hand. Sam squalled in shock and rushed out of the way of the combat. Erica swept him up in her arms. Lakesh drove his knee into an Asian soldier's midriff. The breath left him in a whoosh, and the man doubled up. Lakesh kneed him in the forehead as hard as he could, knocking the man over on his side. Grant and Domi snatched the two remaining men by the collars of their tunics and slammed their faces into each other. Grant and Kane snatched up their sin-eaters. Without hesitation, the five people raced toward the Sandcat and flung themselves into it. Kane took the pilot seat with Grant beside him. Domi climbed up into the caged gunner's saddle, bracing herself on the footrests. Kane keyed the vehicle's engine to rumbling life. At the same instant, he heard the bark of a blaster and a bullet passed uncomfortably close to the open obport. He glanced back toward the soldiers and saw one of them had his SIG AMT to his shoulder. Kane looked to his right and saw the soldiers running toward the vehicle, unlimbering their rifles as they ran. Sam shouted at them, but they couldn't hear what he said. Regardless, he sounded very angry.
To hell with the Imperator!
Kane engaged first gear and tramped the accelerator to the floor. The big wag shot away at a surprisingly high rate of speed, taking Kane completely by surprise as it hurtled over the uneven ground. He wrestled with the wheel as he looked for something like a road, but the whine of bullets passing close kept his foot pressing the pedal to the floor. He found the rutted trail and gunned the cumbersome wag along it. A quick glance to the rear revealed that their pursuers were confused and already outdistanced. He turned to Lakesh.
You say there's a jump chamber in the pyramid?
Lakesh leaned close. Yes, I know how to reach it, but first we have to reach the pyramid.
How did you get here in the first place?
Lakesh smiled ruefully. It's a long story, dearest Bridget. Probably as long as yours. But I'm so happy to see all of you, I'm not too interested in the whys and wherefores at the moment.
The Sandcat roared down the hill. A checkpoint was coming up with a sentry hurrying out of the gatehouse. He tried frantically to wave it off, but the wag raced through the opening. Kane caught a glimpse of the sentry's startled face. He changed gears, pressing the vehicle over the rough track as fast as he dared. The wag reached a cobblestone road, and Kane turned onto it, just as they heard the droning chop of a helicopter. A death bird flew the length of the road.
Ah, shit. That kid's got birds, too?
I fear so. He has a lot of everything.
Painted a matte, non-reflective black, the helicopter's sleek, streamlined contours were interrupted by only the two ventral stub wings. Each wing carried a pod of 16 57mm missiles. Both T-700-701 turboshaft engines were equipped with noise baffles, so only the sound of the steel vanes slicing through the air was audible. Although it wasn't common knowledge, except among the handful of Texan mechanics, the Deathbirds were very old, dating back to the days right before Skydark. They were modified AH-64 Apache attack gunships. The maximum speed of a Deathbird was 186 miles per hour, and its internal fuel range was 300 miles, so there was no chance of either outrunning or outdistancing it, even if they decided to forego the gateway unit and cut across China. The forepart of the Black Chopper was tinted a smoky hue, so the pilot and the gunner were nearly invisible. The jackhammering roar of the M230A1 chain gun in the chin turret sounded like stuttering thunderclaps. The hailstorm of slugs chewed up the grass to their left. The bird climbed and banked, turning in a tight circle so that it was overhead and a little behind them. It hurtled past, the downdraft blasting up clouds of grit and dust which blew through the obports. Kane heard a short tri-burst from the turret MG as Domi fired after the aircraft. Kane glanced at the speedometer. They were racing at more than 70 miles per hour. The pyramid was tantalizingly, mockingly close now. Flickering spear points of yellow flame danced briefly just beneath the chopper's nose. There came a rattling roar, and 50-caliber bullets knocked up great gouts of road behind the Sandcat. Kane jerked the wheel and swerved in a left-to-right zigzag. Bullets slammed into the rear end as he steered the vehicle beneath an arch formed by the intertwining boughs of tall evergreen trees, where the Sandcat was temporarily hidden from the crew of the chopper. He heard the strong thrum of the engines and whirling blades as the helicopter hovered over the arch, then moved on. Kane braked to a halt, coming to a snap, almost insane decision. He put the Sandcat in neutral.
Everybody out!
Kane walked along the side of the road and, after a brief search, found a heavy lump of sandstone on the roadside, weighing around 30 pounds. With the driver's side door open, he stood beside the vehicle, hefted the stone, and jammed it down on the gas pedal. As the engine roared, Kane carefully pressed down on the clutch and engaged the first gear. Kane released the clutch and flung himself away from the Sandcat. The vehicle leaped forward, the rear tires barely missing the toe of his boots. It barreled out from beneath the tree arch, and the helicopter whirled, descended, and zoomed in, its landing gear barely 10 feet above the road. The snout of the chain gun flickered with fire, and 50-caliber slugs punched a cross-stitch pattern in the road in front of and to the left of the vehicle. With the rear of the chopper facing them, Kane, Bridget, Grant, Domi, and Lakesh began running toward the pyramid, hoping to put considerable distance between them and the helicopter before its crew realized no one was driving the vehicle. At the sound of the crash, Kane looked behind him. The Sandcat had plowed into a tree, tipping it to the right. Its momentum might have carried it on over, but a storm of bullets striking the bodywork caused it to list, tilt, then crash onto its side. The helicopter hung over it like the bird of death it was named after, strafing the body with steady bursts. One burst punctured the fuel tank, and its contents went up in a brilliant fireball. The Deathbird wheeled away from the licking flames, and for an instant, the entire area was illuminated by the orange-yellow flare. In that instant, the tinted, bubble-enclosed cockpit of the helicopter was facing the five people.
So much for my brilliant improvisation.
What do you suggest we do, friend Kane?
Run!
All of them began running again, along the tree line, at an oblique angle to the pyramid's nearest corner. The Deathbird did a figure eight from east to west and made a roaring pass, driving down from the rear. Bullets exploded dirt all around them. They dropped flat just as the chopper roared overhead. It came so close to the pyramid that it banked sharply to port, the vanes nearly scoring stone blocks. Rolling onto his back, Grant squeezed off 3 shots from his Sin Eater as the chopper ascended, correcting for the decreasing range.
Let's find out if they're suckers for decoys.
Ignoring the angry shouts from Bridget and Grant, Kane leaped to his feet, ran Brokenfield style across the open courtyard surrounding the base of the pyramid. The Deathbird's pilot straightened and leveled off, but by then Kane was nearly to the structure's corner. The chain gun spat lead and noise and flame again. Bullets kicked up dirt in waist-high fountains 2 yards behind him. Kane dived headlong toward the pyramid and rolled. The Deathbird roared overhead, the landing gear nearly scraping the ground. At the far edges of his hearing, he heard Grant's Sin Eater roaring at full auto. The chopper heeled to starboard and struggled to ascend out of range of the blaster fire. The whirling blades sliced into the side of the pyramid, digging out pounds of stone in dust-filled eruptions. Sparks showered as steel struck stone, and the main rotor snapped with a painfully high-pitched musical chime. In a lurching sideslip, the Deathbird seemed to bounce away from the pyramid. The main rotor assembly continued to spin with broken, jagged stems. The aircraft cannonaded port first against the pyramid's face. The Deathbird was swallowed by a billowing red-orange ball as the Hi-X warheads in its stub wings detonated on impact. A roaring ball of red-yellow flame mushroomed out from the ruptured fuel tank. Kane recoiled as the hard, hot wall of air, pushed forward by the thundering explosion, slapped his face. Debris rained to the ground, pieces of half-slagged and smoldering metal mixed in with blackened chunks of stone. Kane rose unsteadily to his feet and backed away from the conflagration. Grant, Domi, Bridget, and Lakesh raced up to him. He was still dazed and for a second didn't recognize Lakesh.
We're very close to it now. Let's get inside, quickly.
Kane was only dimly aware of running down a dark passageway, his footsteps echoing like the beat of distant drums. Then he saw the gateway unit, with its armor-glass walls glistening like molten gold. Lakesh punched in the destination lock code on the keypad. Grant slammed the door behind him, and the jump mechanism was triggered. The metal discs in the floor and ceiling of the Mat-Trans chamber shimmered, the glow slowly intensifying like condensed fire. A fine mist gathered and wafted down from overhead. A vibrating hum arose, climbing rapidly to a high-pitched whine. Voices began to shout outside the chamber, and fists pounded on the armaglass. Grant squeezed Domi's shoulder reassuringly. She eyed him strangely at first, and then realized he wasn't trying to reassure her, but rather himself, that she was still alive. Grant pulled her close to him.
Never again.
Never again what?
Grant didn't answer. As he entered the darkness, he clasped Domi's hand in his, feeling the solid warmth of her touch, and closed his eyes. He knew her hand would still be there when he opened them again. Outlander's Purgatory Road is a Graphic Audio production. Outlanders and all characters are trademarks owned by Harlequin Enterprises Limited, used by others under license. Copyright 2001, Worldwide Library, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2004, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Terrence Aselford, Nanette Savard, Thomas Penny, Richard Rowan, and Colleen Delaney. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Terrence Aselford. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Terrence Aselford. The Outlander's theme was composed by Norman Vandersleis. If you enjoyed Outlanders, be sure to look for James Axler's Deathlands, available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for a preview of another Graphic Audio title.
If you can't find that hot Graphic Audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, Download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.